Hello, I'm Raj Mehta, and I'm here with Richard Lehman. And welcome back to EPM with Richard Lehman. Today, Richard and I are going to be talking about a lovely topic, which is polypharmacy and polypharmacy versus optimizing medications. Because in primary care, we often have this challenge with multiple medications. In the old days, when we were dealing with chronic diseases, maybe we had one or two drug classes for treatment of a condition. So it's quite straightforward how do we go about it. But nowadays, PCPs, we're faced with so many options and a lot of recommendations to combine many different types of treatments and drugs and classes by newer guidelines. So how do we, as primary care physicians, juggle all these increasing combination of medications for chronic diseases? Should we be promoting a cocktail of medications? Should we be concerned about the excess in the polypharmacy when we add so many meds together and are increasingly aging patients? And Richard and I have decided that a great example and topic to discuss this would be CHF, because CHF has had a medley of new medications and indications and much discussion about the best way to being managed.
We're already on a roll here because we've got so many different things about CHF, not least the what do those actual those letters actually stand for.
Yes.
But what we are going to try and concentrate on is how we envisage evidence-based medicine as coping with this question of additive polypharmacy, a sort of geological accumulation of different drugs. And how are we ever going to apply the principle of clean, simple, randomized controlled trials to the clinical situation we face with these people? Type 2 diabetes is another example, but we'll probably concentrate mostly on CHF, which stands, as far as I'm concerned, for chronic heart failure. Some people would say it stands for congestive heart failure. Others would argue that it stands for, I don't know what the C would stand for, but it stands for half of heart failure, because only half of heart failure has been properly trialed, and that's the half with reduced left systolic ejection fraction. So we've already got a complex situation where patients come to us with breathlessness, which we diagnose as cardiac in origin, and then we move from there to see what we should be treating them with, or at least that's one situation. There are many situations in which these patients present both to us in primary care and to the hospital services, both in general internal medicine and in cardiology. So, having well and truly described a pond full of life, I think we'll now try and work out which bits of this pond life we're going to look at and what we're going to do with them, Raj. So, I'll leave it to you to perhaps choose a question, and then we'll try and use that as a starting point.
So a great point of entry for this are general medications available for CHF for chronic heart failure. And if I look at guideline recommendations today, there's quite a lot of medications. Classically, we're breaking this up into reduced ejection fraction or preserved. And so if we talk about our patients with reduced EF, predominantly less than 40% and quite stable, what medications are guidelines recommending? And the general cocktail includes a beta blocker, an ACE/ARB, or now with the AR-NLPs, you will add perhaps a mineral receptor antagonist. Now the new drugs, SGLT2s. So those are kind of four medications you have, in addition to frequently given loop diuretics, for symptomatic and acute treatments. So that's four or five drugs you've got there. Most of them have been studied in RCTs individually or perhaps in pairs, but there's no, to my knowledge, any RCTs that look at all four in combination. And they're all recommended based on these studies, and some of them which are quite old, showing improvement in mortality and outcomes. And that's kind of the main goal and focus of those recommendations.
Sure. Having agreed with you that there are now more medications than ever before, and that perhaps they each have a place, I'll go back to being the prehistoric monster that I occasionally pose as, looking back to the era before heart failure was really considered worth
I was hoping you would
bothering
talk
with
about
at
that a
all.
little bit. I'm going to learn something here from you too, Richard. This will be good.
I was on the wards first as what they used to call a house officer, doctor in the house, in 1976, and the first tranche of patients I had on my long weekend on included 11 patients with myocardial infarction, and they were treated according to the protocols of the day by me and whoever else was around. Some of them arrested. About half of them went into crashing heart failure, and two or three of them died that weekend. So it was a baptism of fire for me and absolutely ghastly for the patients. There was no coronary care unit. We're up all night trying to look after these dying people, and with more of them coming through the doors, and a lot of other stuff as well. So I learned to hate heart failure on my first weekend of clinical practice, basically, and I've hated it ever since, because it's a very depressing condition. It's a mode of dying as much as anything in some cases. And in those days, the main support for myocardial infarction was lidocaine to prevent fatal arrhythmias. In fact, we were killing more patients with the lidocaine than we were saving them. So that's how primitive it was in the middle of the 1970s. And later on, some of these patients would appear in clinic or be readmitted with pulmonary edema, unable to cope. And all we could do was give them large doses of loop diuretics and watch them die. But in fact, what we didn't realize was that we were actually benefiting some of them because we were combining the loop diuretic with aldosterone blockade in the form of spironolactone, which is already around then. But the clever doctor said, why use spironolactone? Why not just give them potassium? So actually the most valuable treatment we were giving them was being abandoned at that time. And the most dangerous treatment that we were giving them, which was long-acting antiarrhythmics, was being promoted. So basically, evidence-based medicine was a fantastic thing for these people and improved their mortality. And we began to see less of acute pulmonary edema in general practice, which I then went into, partly because ACE inhibitor trials were being done in the early 1980s. ACE inhibitors seem to be a major step forward, but we now know that in fact their effect size and benefit is probably less than that of mineralocorticoid receptor antagonism using our old friend spironolactone. And this is the way that evidence-based medicine goes. Evidence-based medicine is based on evidence, and we only have limited evidence. Unless we've got extra evidence, we can't know how to deploy drugs. And in heart failure, it was decided very early on that the criterion for entry into trials of new treatments was going to be radionuclide ventriculography. Now, nobody does that much these days, but it's a way of assessing how much of the blood that enters the left ventricle gets expelled with each systole, and that's called the ejection fraction. It soon became evident that it was much easier to measure it with new forms of ultrasound, but they didn't correlate terribly well with the old radionuclide. In fact, a lot of what was already being promoted as evidence-based medicine for the ACE inhibitors was actually extrapolation based on less accurate measurements and different populations. It also became clear that reduced ejection fraction was associated with heart failure in quite a few people, though it was also found in population studies that you could have a remarkably low ejection fraction for no particular reason and functioned pretty well. Conversely, it was found that about half the elderly patients with heart failure, clinical syndrome of peripheral edema and pulmonary edema, which was obviously cardiac in origin, was associated with an apparently normal ejection fraction. So it all became a little bit messy early on in the 90s, and that was when I started getting interested in heart failure. So this long story of a personal journey is about to end now with the death of my father from heart failure, and that was in 1991, and that was straightforward post-myocardial infarction, reduced ejection fraction. Reduced ejection fraction basically means that you've lost a lot of your cardiac myocytes. They're dead, they're replaced by fibrous tissue. The fibrous tissue itself can bulge and deform the ventricle, and all sorts of horrible things happen with neuro endocrine results that tend to form a cascade into death. Now, that's what happened to him, and I was the person to look after him at home because he had several miserable hospital admissions, and I became very interested in looking after people dying from heart failure at home. At the same time, I was interested in detecting heart failure in time to treat it with these new drugs, particularly the ACE inhibitors, which seem to promise better results the earlier you use them. And at the same time, a chemical signature of heart failure was appearing in the literature, and I was one of the first GPs to notice it. And it was, in those days, it was called brain natriuretic peptide. And later on, it became known as B-type natriuretic peptide because it's produced not by the brain, but by the cardiac ventricles in large quantities, whether the left ventricle or the right ventricle strained. It pumps out a huge amount of this sort of endofruzamide that tries to make you piss more. So that's my story from prehistory into the middle dinosaur period. what I'm trying to do here is update myself and turn into a small mammal by the end of this talk, because things have happened, you know, comets have landed, and complexity has arisen. We have a whole lot more options. And in the meantime, we have this thing called evidence-based medicine, which sort of happened at the same time as I was a dinosaur. And now I'm trying to sort of become a small mammal, either nibbling at the flanks of evidence-based medicine or trying to reinvent it for a largely mammalian population. Anyway, that's enough of my fantasy metaphors.
Oh, gosh. It's great fun, Richard. I could listen to you go on and on about this. It's wonderful to recapture that history as well.
And so we end up in the same situation as David Sackett was in the middle of the 1990s, having a primitive computer system from which we could look up evidence about the latest trials and then trying to apply those trials to patients. In his case, patients lying in beds in the John Radcliffe Hospital. And in my case, patients at home in the small town of Banbury, about 25 miles away. So that's scene setting. And now we come on to Raj's question, how do we deploy all these different drug classes? What is going to guide us? But I've spoken for long enough.
It's a wonderful segue because I think this, when we're discussing EBM, it really, the context and the history of it is so important. It's knowing how were things in the 80s and the early 90s and how EBM was really such an important transformative fixture because, you know, what were clinicians to do with these conditions? And then to have, you know, this new standard, this degree of evidence to support this drug is really going to be helpful. And then to have confidence that that's what should be do, that's what we should do. And then along with information technology and the internet, to be able to disseminate that knowledge and kind of transform practices to have consistency with what the evidence supports rather than people guessing or just trying to empirically do what they see in front of them. And it's hugely informative and hugely transformative. And so when you have the initial drugs, when you have ACEs come out and then beta blockers come out in this time period, and then subsequently the reintroducing, you know, your mineral receptor antagonists like spironolactone, which we used before, now are now back in vogue because evidence supports it. There's a great deal to celebrate there, and that was, I'm sure, amazing for so many patients to have that and whose lives improved. But then we kind of are now into more modern problems with EBM, and the modern problems begin with what do we do with this cocktail of multiple drugs, and from an EBM rules perspective. You know, there's a couple ways you can think about if you have multiple class of medications for a chronic disease. We can say, well, when you combine these drugs, you know, if we studied each individually and we know each individually has some benefit, perhaps combining them, there's an additive benefit. Some might argue perhaps there's a synergistic benefit. So maybe the benefits aren't just additive, but perhaps they multiply. If we're more skeptical, we might worry that, you know, each of these drugs studied individually, when you combine them, perhaps the benefit's not additive, perhaps it diminishes and their benefit is not as great. Or in the worst case scenario, perhaps there's some subtractive harms even because, you know, each one of these drugs have harms, the benefits are studied individually. So if their cumulative benefit doesn't add up, but the harms do, does that change your risk benefit analysis? And so it's a bit tricky when we look at these things and we worry about our patients. And then there's argument whether, can we just make recommendations based on individual RCTs themselves? I mean, the data is quite great. Or do we need to have more studies, you know, to really know how to combine all these medications? That's kind of the tricky balance that we now face.
It certainly is. EBM is started with the idea of the clean science of controlled trials, controlling for variables. It's a lovely idea, but of course, we have an entirely uncontrolled practice. At least general practice in the UK is uncontrolled. Anybody can walk through the door and present any problem whatsoever. And it's the same with the cardiac population. And I think there are two issues that perhaps we should discuss before we get on to the individual drug classes. And one is the issue of age. At one end of the age spectrum, we have the pediatric patients. We won't talk about them specifically, but some of those become young adults with congenital heart disease, and they have varying degrees of heart failure with reduced ejection fraction, but also with either cardiomyopathy affecting the way that their cardiomyocytes contract, or valvular problems, or the fibrosis and distortion of previous surgery and its effect. So they become joined in the 30s age group upwards with people who have had myocardial infarction. And they are becoming rarer because myocardial infarction is becoming rarer, a lot rarer. And so we have ischemic heart disease and cardiomyopathy in its strict sense, and adult valvular heart disease or congenital heart disease and its long-term consequences, and a few other subgroups such as the cardiomyopathic effects of some cancer treatments, not just drugs, but also radiation. So we've got those, and they are reasonably easy to access. And they are very keen to stay alive, very keen to stay alive, as you would be. And then from the age of 65 upwards, and particularly after 70, you get people who tend to have much more complex background disease, a lot of hypertension, diabetes, smoking-related disease, lung disease, and increasing comorbidity generally, and perhaps a slightly different philosophy of life in that they want to make the most of what remains to them, and quality of life then becomes very important, and an endless trooping to clinics to have this or that adjusted may not be the way that people want to spend their lives. And in fact, the average patient nowadays with heart failure and reduced ejection fraction is about 79 in the UK. And the average patient with preserved ejection fraction heart failure is probably just a couple of years older and more likely to be a woman. But it, you know, we're talking about a predominantly elderly population, while at the same time we should not forget the younger ones, because I think they do legitimately require a closer and more focused view of cardiac function and what we can do about it, even up to the point of transplantation or left ventricular assist devices. And I don't think we can avoid the ageism bit in that.
That's very true.
That's my feeling. As I say, it's not just a question of our moral viewpoint as to who best deserves intensive treatment. It's also the patient's own viewpoint of whether they want intensive treatment and what the goals of that treatment are. I think we make the assumption that everybody wants to live longer. Now, there have been conflicting studies on this, and in the earlier ones, up to 50% or more of heart failure patients in New York classes 3 and 4 who are actually having trouble getting about and doing the ordinary activities of life, expressed a preference for treatments that would actually give them a bit of a boost, allow them to do more, and then drop dead sooner. That some of them would. And we have very good drugs for doing that. They're called beta agonists. But instead, we give them beta adrenergic antagonists, because that draws out the life, it relieves the heart, allows them to do less to start with, and so we have to titrate them gradually and persuade the patient to keep on with them. And some people can tolerate them and some people can't, but they don't actually have any symptomatic benefit by and large, although you could twist the or argue evidence one way or the other. Certainly people live longer on them, and so they become standard treatment in addition to drugs in the RAAS cascade. I'm once again in a bit of a monologue here, but if you
this is good.
Bear with me, you'll notice that until recently, all the drugs for heart failure were bits of the renin, angiotensin, aldosterone system. They knocked off bits, and oddly enough, renin was the last one that they tried knocking off, and that proved to be the to be harmful, in fact. And all of them have the capacity to cause activation of the histamine system and keep histamine and bradykinins hanging around for longer than they should, and therefore, particularly in some racial groups, they tend to cause angioedema. And they're not always very easily tolerated. They do tend to cause postural hypotension. They cause vasodilatation. That may even be their main mode of action. We don't know. But anyway, that was a simple story, and then it became complicated once people started adding in drugs which work in different ways, and sacubitril was one of them, and it was rather oddly trialed in combination with valsartan against ACE inhibitors, and so we've got a mixture of different trials in the RAAS system, and then all of a sudden, quite out of left field, a diabetes drug came along and proved to be actually quite a lot better than,
than
what was already there. So, you know, that was a gift from the gods, and totally unexpected by the trialists, who suddenly found that they had far fewer deaths from heart failure in their active group when they were doing the, I think it was the empagliflozin trial.
Yes, I think so too. How often do we surreptitiously come across such great discoveries? You know, it seems medicine seems to often work that way.
Absolutely, it does. So anyway, that's where we stand at the moment. And as a skeptic about the possibility of clean EBM, my question is, how do you, as a clinician, talk about this with a man of 80 who can barely leave the house, whose wife has to do everything for him, who has been on an ACE inhibitor for ages, who has tried increasing it and failed because he's fallen over a couple of times and got admitted to hospital, broken his humerus on one of these occasions, and he can no longer do the things that he enjoys. And he knows he's dying, and he's been in hospital a couple of times with exacerbations of heart failure. And what are you going to do for him? And I realize that that's a very dirty question.
No, it's good.
But it's one that you will face every week, basically.
It's one we all face. And just to clarify, this is a hypothetical situation. Richard's not describing himself. I think you're in good health and quite active now, Richard, right?
Yeah, I'm not 80 yet either, although I look it, I know, but and sound it. But yeah, this is not me. It's a bit like my dad, who was 78
when he died.
And absolutely, it's a horrific situation, and that's why the book I wrote was not about maximal medical treatment for heart failure. It was about heart failure and palliative care, because I think at some point you have to admit that, you know, that this whole idea of maximal medical treatment and then put them on, give them an ICD and, you know, fiddle about as you will with pacing and complex treatments. Great if you're a 60-year-old who wants to live for as long as possible, try everything. But I think at some point, some kind of humane conversation has to be had as to how you're going to proceed. And that may not be up titrating every conceivable drug. Now, that's a separate issue.
I
thought I would have to go there because it's very, very close to my own heart.
I think it's where our conversation needs to end up, because that's really the goal of where we're trying to get to.
Maybe one goal. Let's now say that we are dealing with a 60-year-old and he or she has been through quite a lot of different treatments, and she's on a list of, say, 8 drugs, including a beta blocker, an ACE inhibitor, and sacubitril, valsartan, possibly, and an SGL2 inhibitor, a 2T2 inhibitor. And so she's on state-of-the-art treatment. They're trying to persuade her to have an ICD, but that's a separate issue. A cardiologist she's seen says that she's got hibernating myocardium, and that there might be a benefit from surgery to reperfuse that. So you've got those things going on, but you've got a list of drugs, and a cardiologist has told you to prescribe them all, and she says to you, "Look, Dr. Mehta," or she may even call you Raj, "I've known you for 5 years. You're a clever guy. I trust you more than I do this guy I've seen in the last clinic I went to, and he's trying to say that I've got to increase my dose of these things. But how do you know that half these things are working? Surely what we should be trying is just to see if I can do better. I've been all right for the last few months. You know, I can get out to the shops, and to be honest, I'm doing now more now than I was a year ago. So what are we going to do about maybe cutting out one or two of these guys? So that's the other side of the coin, yeah?
Yeah. So when I'm thinking about this, if I'm putting on my ABM hat, right, there's a lot of nuance to go through this. And I think you've touched on a lot of this, which is that, you know, it's not always as straightforward as taking a clinical trial and applying it to a patient. You have to consider, you know, patient characteristics, their age, other aspects of disease status, how does that generalize? And I think most fundamental to this is, and what you've highlighted, is really knowing our patient, listening to them, understanding what their goals are, what their preferences are, taking an approach where we do the shared decision-making, as you stated, have a shared understanding. So like first and foremost with any patient, you know, is to listen, to know them, even when they tell me make the decision for them. Hopefully if I've known them for a long time, I have a sense of what their goals are, what their preferences are, and you know, kind of go over that of where they want to be and what they want to be doing. When it comes to thinking about the medications, I think the most important thing we have to keep in mind is, you know, different medicines have different magnitude of benefit and on different outcomes. So if it's a young person in her 60s, and I know she wants to live another 10, 15 years, spend time with her grandkids and so on, and I know a certain class of medications really have a dramatic, a large effect size on helping with that goal of improving mortality, I might be stronger in making that recommendation. You know, on the flip side, if I had an older patient in their 80s, and there was a drug that could help improve mortality, but the survival gains are shorter because they're older, I may be honest about those benefits, but that may be a different balance against their goals of perhaps having more quality of life or having less pills they have to take. And then even then, you know, if I had an 80-year-old type 1 diabetic, I'd still tell them to take their insulin. So there's some meds, well, I'll never say, please don't take it, you know. And I think In heart failure, the newest drugs, the SGLT2s, are so incredible. I mean, when you think about the fact that they can reduce your risk of hospitalization by 40-50% and just help with a lot of those volume issues, I think even elderly patients are ones that could really benefit from that. I think whether you're focusing on your mortality outcomes or just quality of life things, I think those are really great. When you start getting to other things like should you maximally titrate your beta blockers? Do you really need an ARNP in addition to the ACE? Do you really need the spironolactone? You have to go one by one and see where they're at and see what they're willing to do, and balance and trade those things. But again, I think it begins with, knowing their patient's preferences and then being honest and transparent about what are these magnitude of benefits we're seeing and what outcomes do they work on.
Yes, and I think that general approach is absolutely right. The question then arises, how do you do clinical trials to back your hunches on this? And I think the short answer is that yes, do them, but don't expect the results to translate into anything that could be used by clinicians within a time period of say 5 years or so, because they are very, very complex to do. Maybe I'm being over
Yeah, I do sometimes. One thing I do worry about nihilism sometimes. Like, there's, if we're going to be honest about EBM, we have, if we find new drugs, even if we haven't studied them comparatively together, we tend to have the baseline assumption that the benefit is going to be at least be additive or not add harm. So if there's four different class of drugs that can help people live longer with heart failure, I feel that, an honest EBM approach would be to say then we should recommend all four. Now if it's diabetes, a lot of times we mix and match a lot of diabetes drugs. We don't always have RCTs combining them yet in practice. We'll do it practically based on what the patient's needs are. So I think in heart failure, if we're trying to help people live longer and have quality of life, I do think that, the recommendation is to say, consider all these medications and offer to patients if they're willing to take it. It makes sense. I worry that if we always start demanding every time there's a new med, we have to bunch together new RCTs, it's going to create a lot of burden. But then again, sometimes it's appropriate. I mean, I think the ICD example you gave, those trials showing benefit in very severe heart failure was, 20 years ago when many of these modern medications were not available. I think many of us are skeptical or unsure if that same benefit is still true. So sometimes, yes, we probably do need to revisit old evidence and consider combinations. But at the same time, I think we have to kind of be have some practicality and accept some assumptions are necessary to say, okay, we think this is the best way going forward until we have those trials.
You persuaded me of that, people have rather associated me with great torrents of grumbling about additive treatments for heart failure, and I don't entirely repent those. But on the other hand, I think we are faced now with a situation where we've got particularly one great new drug class, and there's some evidence of symptomatic benefit. And I think symptomatic benefit is perhaps slightly neglected in this in favor of reduced hospitalization. But let's not argue about these little details. I think what we're doing is trying to improve the mortality and the burden of heart failure to individuals as well as to society. And it's time that happened, to be honest, because although the cardiology community has boasted that it's the most evidence-based area of medicine, heart failure treatment, the figures don't bear out any great improvement in prognosis over the last 15 to 20 years, which is odd, really, when you consider how much extra clinical effort's been.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
That may change now. And we're hoping, of course, that it changes. But we also have to look to improvements in supportive and palliative care, because a lot of these
Yes.
patients are in the group where they're going to die with or of heart failure. And it's not a very good, not a very nice way to go, to be honest.
My fear with these things always is that, there's always a lot of nuance and an understanding of patients' goals, and then very easily in practice, we now become burdened with quality metrics, and then it's very easy to make recommendations into demands that, oh, you have this many patients, get them on this many meds. And sometimes you lose a lot of the opportunity to apply that nuance and stuff. And so we also have to be cautious of that and mindful of that. Okay, we have recommendations, we have understandings, but let's not jump the gun and then demand everyone do everything all the time either.
Well, that's the trouble, and there is this this sort of guideline. Guidelines become tramlines. They become diktats. Quality metrics arise from persuading patients to have treatments instead of allowing shared decision making to inform those. On the other hand, if we're going to do shared decision making, we need to hold ourselves to high professional standards of knowledge and communication, and so it's a circular process of never-ending effort towards improvement. But half of that circular activity is simply to maintain what we've got, and that's what often isn't realized. Instead of looking for constant improvement, sometimes we should suffice to maintain the standards we already have, because they're pretty difficult to keep up to. And we also have to be very welcoming of people who will help us do our jobs, including pharmacists, specialist nurses, and so on. Because if we're constantly looking up potassium levels and thinking about the next dose titration we need to do, we're perhaps wasting out the skills that we should be using on communicating with the patient at a deeper level, or vice versa. Anyway, I think we've had a great discussion on this.
Oh, this has been lovely, Richard. It's been great. I think it's been
and
a
I'm
very good.
To do my post-COVID coughing bout. So perhaps we'll end there and maybe have a similar discussion about type 2 diabetes before long.
I think so. I think that'll be very good. Thank you, Richard.
Okay, great. Thanks very much, Rob.
Bye.
Bye-bye.